Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine the state of labor in America with a labor organizer and educator and an historian of American labor. First, we will speak with Les Leopold, who directs the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute and is a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations like the Sierra Club and the United Steelworkers Union. Then, to get a sense of where the labor movement stands today in comparison to its strength and percentage of the workforce that was unionized in previous decades, we will speak with Leon Fink, who edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. We will discuss what might revive the labor movement and restore the American dream as the current recession deepens and jobs, or the lack of them, become grist for the political mill in the upcoming election year. I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's an analyst with NBC News and a Bloomberg View columnist. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and The Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and The Promise, President Obama, Year One. He has an article at Bloomberg View, America's Lost Decade. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Jonathan Alter.
My pleasure.
And the article uses the fresco in the ceiling of the U.S. Rotunda, which we often see in low angles when they interview politicians inside the U.S. Capitol, and the extent to which fully one-third of the ceiling is devoted to scientists and inventors like Franklin and Samuel Morse. And the point that you make in your article, The Last Decade, is that we are now faced with a possibility of a presidential, we certainly have a presidential candidate, but even a possible, and he's leading in the Republican presidential field, a possible president who is anti-science. And I'm curious as to why the United States, given its global hegemony, has so much to do with science and invention, why it would abdicate that kind of hegemony so blithely.
Well, I don't think we have abdicated it yet, but what's happened is that one of our political countries in the United States is in the grip of a radical fringe that has become hostile to science across a broad front. And then we have independents and some Democrats who find various things that they might be unhappy about with President Obama and just pocket or otherwise don't credit the things that he's done to advance science and the environment and other rational things, which in some cases people don't know about, or in other cases they are of such a purist frame of mind that they don't recognize just how much worse a Republican president, particularly Governor Perry of Texas, would be on these kinds of issues. So you get... When there's a Republican president, Republicans close rank behind him. Even when Ronald Reagan raised taxes, which of course is anathema to conservatives, they didn't whine and act like crybabies about him. But you can't really necessarily say the same thing about Democrats. So that's weakened President Obama and put us into a position where he's vulnerable. Obviously, the backdrop to all that is the terrible economy and the 9% unemployment.
But Jonathan Alter, is there a kind of creeping theocracy here? Because there's so much of the core support now for the Republican Party, and there's no question that Governor Perry began his campaign by having a religious revival meeting in Houston. Now, clearly, a big part of the message to the faithful gathered there was, I am not a Mormon. However, you can't escape the connection between the religious right and Governor Perry.
No, you can't at all. I mean, other presidents have kind of used the religious right, and that includes President Reagan, the first President Bush, and especially George W. Bush. And while I don't want to denigrate the degree of their religious faith, they mostly were using the religious right as a political instrument. In Perry's case, he believes all this stuff, and he's very much with them, not just politically, but in his heart. It's very obvious from his comments over the years. I spoke recently to somebody who traveled with him to the Middle East, and was their takeaway from the trip was that he was a religious zealot. So this is the kind of thing that again, there will be certain people who will vote for him because they want this kind of America, but there aren't enough of them to elect Perry. So the only way Perry gets elected is if somehow independents and Democrats get so hornswoggled, so bamboozled by whomever, that they cannot see their own self-interest and the interests of the country in remaining a non-sectarian society clearly. So the stakes are very high. And, you know, when I hear on your broadcast or on other broadcasts a lot of whining about President Obama, it's not put in the context that it needs to be, which is that this is not about President Obama. It's about a choice between President Obama and something that would be not just a little bit worse, but infinitely worse for this country. And so I hope, you know, in the 14 months between now and the election, less than 14 months, that when progressives get together, talk on the radio, on television, it is done in this context. These are the stakes. The stakes are that we will no longer be you know, on the leading edge of scientific and medical research, and that we will have a flight from reason toward narrow faith. And that's a lot more than, you know, you don't like this decision or that decision by President Obama.
But Jonathan Aldrin, it is not a strong argument, and it's unfortunately an all too frequent one, that you have to vote for your guy even if you're disappointed in him, because the Supreme Court could go radical right or whatever. It's usually the specter of something terrible rather than, you know, an inspiring narrative. And it's clear that the right has a narrative, but it's not very clear that the Democrats have a narrative.
Well, I think you're right about that. And in my earlier book, The Promise, I was critical of the president for not having more of a narrative, for not having a better communication strategy. I liked this recent speech that he gave on jobs, but I thought it was at least a year and a half, maybe even 2 years later than it should have been. So you can say all of these things, but this is, you know, politics is always the art of the possible. And as the president himself says, you don't want to make the perfect or even the very good the enemy of the acceptable, and the failure to imagine you know, what life would be like if we essentially repeal the New Deal, which is what's at stake here, if we have we're one vote away from having a radical Supreme Court, radical right Supreme Court, and, you know, all the other things that, well beyond a Supreme Court, that a president who is ideological and hostile to the achievements of progressivism over the last 100 years, the consequences of that so dwarf any possible disappointment, in some cases, I believe, a misplaced disappointment in this president, that it almost boggles the mind. And so, you know, I basically, I hate to sound harsh about this, but my message to progressives, and this will be my message to them to the extent that anybody cares about what I have to say, but over the next year, is grow up. You know, we're talking about politics here. We're not talking about some platonic ideal of what government should be. Now, did everybody have, including me, everybody have unrealistic expectations about what Barack Obama could deliver if we elected him president? Did he misplay his hand at various points? Yes. But even the details of that are much more complicated than most people assume. And, you know, I found in the extensive interviews that I did for The Promise that a lot of these things, like, oh, the stimulus should have been bigger, very easy to say, but at the time it simply wasn't possible, you know. And so there are complications here that a lot of progressives miss when they're assessing these events.
Can I speak with Jonathan Aldrin? He's an analyst for NBC News and a Bloomberg View columnist. His latest book is The Promise, President Obama 1 Year Later. He has an article at Bloomberg View, America's Lost Decade. But as much as you're concerned about Perry, Jonathan Alter, surely the more frightening prospect for President Obama's re-election chances is Mitt Romney getting the nomination.
Yes, that's true. that's true. Romney would be harder to beat than Perry, but we also don't know where the economy is going to be next year, and the indications are not very positive. So it shouldn't be. The idea of a Perry presidency is still quite possible, and he's not to be underestimated as a shrewd politician.
Well, this gets to this puzzlement that I have, and I wonder if there's a sort of Stockholm syndrome, a political version of the Stockholm syndrome here. What explains the fact that you had the euphoria of 2008, and a tremendous number of people voted, 140 million voted. 2 years later, in 2010, about 80 million or so voted, a huge drop-off, and all of the Republicans voted, and a lot of disappointed Democrats didn't vote. Now, that is more likely to happen again in 2012, that same phenomenon.
So, no, I don't think so. Barack Obama was not on the ballot. Young people traditionally don't vote in midterm elections. The elderly vote in much greater numbers. And the Republicans ran a campaign that was not noticed by a lot of pundits, but that basically was accusing Obama of hurting Medicare because there are some responsible Medicare cuts that were in subsidies to the wealthy that were eliminated by the Obama health care law. And so they used that, the Republicans used that, to really drum up a lot of support from the elderly, who already had been, they were the only group that supported McCain. So they voted much heavier numbers. They're more dutiful. And we might not be seeing, and Hispanics traditionally don't vote much in midterm elections, and they stayed true to form on this. So drop-off between presidential and midterm was not exceptionally high, but it by historical standards. But it still, as you said, was from about 130 million to about 80 million. And so I would actually view that as something that's encouraging for the Democrats, assuming that the base doesn't act in a immature way and decide that it will sit on its hands and give the country to the radical right. You know, we've seen this movie before. In 2000, there were a number of progressives who either stayed home or they voted for Ralph Nader, and we know what happened that year. And in 1968, some of your older listeners, you know, may recall that there were supporters of Gene McCarthy who had qualms about Hubert Humphrey because he'd been a supporter of the Vietnam War until toward the end of the campaign. They didn't like him very much, and so they sat on their hands, and we got Richard Nixon and all the things that followed that. So,
Also, you can add to that 1980 when Jimmy Carter was challenged in the primary by on the left by Teddy Kennedy, and then in the general by a phony Republican, John Anderson,
right,
and that helped elect Reagan. So we know that there are suicidal tendencies,
right,
on the part of the progressive left. But
I
was curious, though, about on the right, or why, and in the center, which is what Obama's after, why they would be attracted. And my only explanation is a kind of Stockholm syndrome thing where, you know, why would people vote for a party that wants to destroy Medicare, destroy Social Security, and is telling you that you can't have health care, that something's wrong with that. Every other civilized country has it. It's just, a lot of it doesn't make sense. It's a kind of...
I don't agree with you on that. I think it does make sense because you know, if Obama is elected with 9% unemployment, reelected, it would be the first time since 1936 that a president has been reelected in the face of that kind of headwind. Franklin Roosevelt was reelected in 1936 when unemployment was about 14%, but it was down from 25%. So, you know, this is a very tough road just because of the economic condition of the country. And a lot of people who don't vote in off your elections, or many of those who do, they have busy lives. They're not listening to this program or reading, you know, my columns or even watching cable TV, which has a total viewership that's less than one-tenth of the electorate. And they're just going about their lives, and all they know is that they don't have a job, or their brother or cousin doesn't have a job. They will be inclined to at least take a hard look at somebody who can promise them that there might be better times ahead. Now, there are some things that are problematic for Romney, which are just now starting to get attention, and this is where the Republican primaries can be helpful to Obama. Romney, when he was governor of Massachusetts, Massachusetts was 47th out of 50th in job creation. So when he turns to the president, if Romney's the nominee in a debate, and said, you didn't create jobs and I will, the president has a pretty good rejoinder. Well, you had your chance as governor of Massachusetts and you failed. You know, so they both failed in that term, in those mm-hmm. terms. And Perry has had a good jobs record in Texas, presided over job growth in Texas, but their unemployment rate is now moving up pretty quickly and is now at 8.5%, not that far from the national unemployment rate. So, you know, these are basically, if it becomes a referendum on President Obama, up or down, he loses. If it becomes a choice, he's much more likely to win. And so, in saying that, I think it's incumbent on anybody who does not want to have a radical right future to put their analysis of the president, whether they're analyzing his Middle East policy, analyzing his record on the environment, his record on jobs, in a comparative context. And that's not done nearly enough.
Well, Jonathan Alter, though, we haven't really talked about your article, America's Lost Decade, but in that context, you know, my sense is that anger, confusion, and cynicism may be a stronger emotion in this upcoming political year than reasoned disappointment. And will the American people listen and learn from the simple lesson that you're putting out in this article, The Lost Decade? You point out that since we've just observed the 9/11 attacks, 10 years later, what has happened in that 10 years? And it's all disastrous compared to what happened in the 10 years since Pearl Harbor, which is often compared to 9/11. You know, the nation accomplished an extraordinary amount between 1941 and 1951. The GI Bill, the creation of the United Nations, the crushing of fascism around the world, etc. And look what has happened in the 10 years since 9/11. It is so dismal, with 46.2 Americans now living in poverty. Wages haven't risen. We have to take our shoes off at the airport, etc. Is that simple historical lesson going to resonate?
Well, I think it might to a certain extent. Not only were the aughts, the last 10 years, I call them the aughts because that's what they were called 100 years ago, and also it ought to have been different. You know, not only was it worse than the 1990s, it was worse than any decade in the last 100 years in terms of moving this country forward on the domestic side, and it certainly wasn't successful internationally either. But, in terms of what we built, like even during the Depression when nobody had any money, we were building a lot of the infrastructure that we use now. Of course, we built the interstate highway system in the 1950s and in the 60s, civil rights and a lot more. And I kind of take the reader through these decades and just briefly through the last 10 decades. It's a relatively short column. And then try to explain how unfavorably the last 10 years have compared. We basically got nothing done, and in terms of advancing the United States, and other than some good work internationally on AIDS, it's really hard to come up with things that were done, that were accomplished by this country in the last 10 years. Now it's true we weren't attacked a second time on George W. Bush's watch, and that's what he'll be pointing to, I'm sure, in his presidential library. But other than that, he stacks up so poorly on the record, just the record of accomplishment or lack thereof, compared to previous decades, even the 1970s, which are considered to be a horrible decade. A lot of important things happened in society. Some of this goes beyond a president. You know, so in the 1970s, we moved toward gender equality, we moved toward environmental protection, and did some other important things. But we just did not move ahead and arguably moved behind in the last 10 years, and that heightens the stakes in this election even more. You know, we can do better, and once we get past some of these economic problems, we're not going to get back to where we were in terms of the bubble economy, mm-hmm. but we can do better, and that's why this infrastructure debate that's going on right now is so important. Mm-hmm.
Well, just in closing, though, the amazing thing is that it's sort of it reminds me of that Naomi Klein book, The Shock Doctrine, is, and how the people who've destroyed the economy or set us back a whole decade are you know, using that as a weapon, and they're using it successfully. I mean, they're the ones that the Republicans, particularly Bush, caused this deficit that now the Republicans hold up as this reason why we have to impoverish ourselves.
That's right. The year 2003 was arguably the most profligate in American history. I mean, you have a $1 trillion war. You have close to a $1 trillion prescription drug benefit that's unpaid for. And of course, you have $1 trillion in tax cuts that are tilted toward the wealthy. So, you know, that's more than $3 trillion, a lot of money. And you're absolutely right. And so they now turn around and want everybody to forget that it was on their watch that this happened. And because of the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, the Koch brothers and their ilk now can spend at will. And so there's a question of whether the same people who got us into this mess might now kind of hijack democracy and put somebody pliable in there. Now certain progressives will say, well, Barack Obama was pliable. Well, to a certain extent he was, and I'm critical of him on that, but you know, there are also things he got done, the credit card bill, and there are things in Dodd-Frank that haven't gotten very much attention that are pretty good. So, you know, it's just time for people to recognize the stakes, stop complaining about their own disappointments, and move toward, using the next election to build a stronger progressive movement, which in the last 3 years hasn't happened. The energy has been on the right. Now, it's easy to blame Obama for that and say, well, you know, he didn't spread his magic dust, but it wasn't really up to him. You know, he said during the campaign, we are the people we've been waiting for. And it's true that he didn't ask enough of that movement. He didn't mobilize it properly. But ultimately, it's the fault of progressives collectively themselves. And the first way to get back toward pursuing, advancing a progressive agenda is to make damn sure that Obama's the president over the next 4 years.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jonathan Alter.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's an analyst for NBC News and Bloomberg View. He's a columnist with Bloomberg View. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days, and The Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines of View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and his latest book, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. He also has an article at Bloomberg View, America's Lost Decade. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the possibility of the euro really crashing.
Because after all, he's just a man. Something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.